I don't think anybody really knew what was going on until they saw people on the ground bleeding and heard people screaming and heard the commotion, because you didn't know. When you're in a bar like that, you really think that it's music.
Traumatized and injured clubbers were helped from the scene and taken to hospital for treatment. One mother received texts from her son who said they were trapped in the toilets and they feared they were going to die. Another mother was distraught trying to find out if her son was still alive.
I don't know where my son is. No one can tell me where my son is. If he's been shot, if he's dead, no one knows. But they told me there are fatalities.
Dozens of emergency vehicles attended outside, including the city's bomb squad and hazardous material team. Immediately following the attack, the gunman is reported to have barricaded himself into the club and taken hostages. The police performed a controlled explosion outside to distract him before he was shot dead. At a news conference, they said he appeared to be armed with an assault-type rifle, a handgun, and some sort of device.
Do we consider this an act of terrorism? Absolutely. We are investigating this from all parties' perspective as an act of terrorism. Any time that we have potentially dozens of victims in any of our communities, then I think we can qualify that as a terrorist activity.
A major investigation is now being undertaken to determine the gunman's motives and whether he was acting alone. Jane Francis Kelly, BBC News.
Right. So the thing is that it's been set up at least since the 70s, whereby it is assumed that if you're a fag, if you're black, if you're a woman, you have to side towards the maternalistic Democratic government party.
That's right. And God help you if you turn your back on them. We gave you marriage. You goddamn better get behind this gun control.
Yeah. And it's immigration gets tied into it. You have a whole nest egg of different points of view that you're supposed to have that go along with the narrative.
Right.
And if they can't quite fight you, they simply ignore you.
Yeah. You can look at a Pew Research poll that simply states that 36% of gay people that they surveyed, and I think they surveyed about 1,000 people, actually supported gun rights. So 36% is not a fringe minority. You know, I think that that is a sign that no, we're not fringe. No, we are not these strange people that don't deserve a voice. I think that if we want to start having this discussion nationwide, that no, you shouldn't just shut us down.
Yeah. Hey everyone, this is Carlos Morales and this is Libertarian Atheist Podcast, and today I have one of the most interesting people today, Jonathan Fisher. How are you doing today, sir?
Oh, I'm doing just peachy, Carlos.
Now, you are a little bit famous today, and apparently you're going to be on a lot more news stories soon enough on the Los Angeles Times.
Front page, September 10th.
Very nice.
If you can go back in time, pick one up, Saturday edition.
Yeah, which God knows people always try to get their news through newspapers.
Yes.
But it'll definitely be at least on the website, which is where I will link people to. And tell me, Jonathan, why are you on there?
I'm on there because I was contacted by a reporter regarding a little group that I founded, co-founded, called the Pink Pistols. The Pink Pistols was founded 16 years ago by Gwen Patton, and she is out in the Philly area, I believe, still. And disabled lesbian who was having some problems with some violence in the area and decided to start carrying a gun around legally, and then started a chapter of other gays and lesbians in the Philly area and the Wilmington, Delaware area to start legally carrying guns and using carry permits and marksmanship and gun safety and things like that. And then it became a nationwide thing over the years. And then suddenly, 3 months ago, Orlando happened, and, group went from a membership of, let's say, probably 1,000 nationwide to about, currently we have something like 9,500 members. It all happened within about 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So,
my role in all this.
Yeah.
Basically, was the Thursday after the Orlando shooting. which was June 12th, I think. That Thursday, I realized online pretty quickly that there was no real West Hollywood chapter, which is where we are today. That the West Hollywood chapter had been founded years earlier, but was largely defunct. It had, I think, active on Facebook, something like 4 members. It was pathetic. And no one had posted in there in probably about 5 years. So I contacted the moderators, and I contacted Gwen Patton. She decided to give me the reins to the West Hollywood group, and we coordinated, and we started to post on a lot of other gun websites and some gay websites. In about a week, we went from 4 to 254 members.
Well done.
Thank you.
Now, Fags with Guns.
Fags with Guns.
All right, yeah. Which I like that name much more than Pink. Well, just because of the pink thing, right? There's an assertion there that there's supposed to be a feminization with homosexuals.
Oh, yes.
Which some of the strongest, manliest men I've ever met were very, very gay.
Yes.
Yeah. So what has been, of course, always the question is, right? Like, who are the biggest shit talkers? Because that's all anyone ever cares about, of course. But has there been a lot of positive in regards from the gay community on this topic?
Unfortunately, no.
No, really?
We have received from within the community, which, you know, they promote diversity, but they do not encourage dissent. And we have run into an unprecedented amount of negativity, and especially from people who you would think would be largely supportive of any kind of rights, like EQCA, which is the group that is known for largely helping to overturn Prop 8. And the new, I think he's the current president or the current director of EQCA, Rick Ziber, quoted several times, even recently, completely denouncing our group and saying that we are going the wrong direction.
Yeah.
It's all in the article.
Yeah. Which, again, everyone should definitely check out. It's surprisingly not hateful of gun owners, which I have to imagine it's because you're part of a supposedly oppressed minority.
Oh, I feel so oppressed right now.
Yeah, especially in West Hollywood.
Hate crime.
God knows people hate gays in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, but see, it's interesting that you bring that up, especially considering when you're talking about West Hollywood, because
your sound's coming in all right.
Oh, no, I'm just pausing because my husband's going to kill me if I don't give you a coaster.
Oh, shit. That's right. Yeah. I'm sure this table costs $6,000. At least. So, you. By the way, you have a beautiful place in West Hollywood. I feel this is ridiculous. Like, I imagine this costs a gajillion dollars.
No, you'd be surprised. Rent control is a real thing.
Oh, man. If you can get in on a rent-controlled spot.
That's right.
That's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, the inner libertarian in me has no idea how to feel about rent control.
No, just let it happen. Right? Because they're taking away so much money from you as it is.
Yeah.
Like, if you didn't have half of your wealth being stolen from you.
Oh, yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
Then, you know, you would be able to afford all the things, right? And even more loss to inflation.
So. I was just going to say, you took the words out of my mouth. It's something that actually the great Dr. Ron Paul said several times in several books, is that there is a hidden tax, is how he calls it, and which is inflation.
Yeah. As far as like people who actually talk about inflation, probably Ron Paul and Ludwig von Mises were kind of the two top people who really were able to get the problem with it. But moving away from coasters and this fabulous table, you were kind of going on more about the Hollywood and gays.
So, everyone knows, especially in the entertainment world or in the press, especially in the press, timing is everything. So the thing that happened, starting, I think, roughly within 24 hours, within a 24-hour period after the Orlando shooting, there was this surge of, let's call it some sort of protest art, that was popping up all over the city of West Hollywood. And West Hollywood's very small. It's dense. It's about 100,000 people, maybe 110,000 people within the incorporated city limits.
Which is how big?
Oh, boy. It's not much, man. It's probably maybe not even 4 miles across.
Jesus.
3 miles, maybe. It's not much. You can walk packed. Across it in about 2 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's.
Pick
so
up six hookers and exactly. a bag of meth in between.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Fucking freedom.
It's amazing. Yeah. But, a lot of people were freaked out when they saw this unidentified artist who
apparently decided to put all over buildings and rooftops a Gadsden flag that was tricked out to be a rainbow flag, you know, symbol of the LGBT community.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the middle of the Gadsden flag, instead of "Don't tread on me," it just said hashtag shoot back.
Oh, that is beautiful.
It was wonderful.
And that'll be the picture for this podcast.
Yes.
That sounds fucking fantastic.
Spread it out there. I have no idea who did it, but...
There's a philosophical question regarding this, right? So there's this assumption that because you can suggest a way by which to handle a particular issue, that therefore you're blaming people, right? This is this is the lowest of the low feminist logic, right? And I don't have a problem with academic feminists in large part throughout history, but when we're talking like Jezebel,
yeah,
that kind of degrading, pathetic form of philosophy where they think that if you say maybe women should start carrying around guns or whatever to protect themselves from something like rape, therefore you are simply insinuating that it is the fault of the woman in this case. And it's really, that's not what you're doing.
No, it's the rapist doing it. It is an individual rapist.
Yeah, I believe women should be able to walk around naked with a $100 bill hanging out their ass and no one should fuck with them. That's my basic view, and I want that for humanity. But as long as we don't have that...
If they so choose.
Yeah, if they... I'm not going to force them to do that. Get naked and hang out with a $100... Yeah, no. No, I'm certainly not going to do that. But that's the dream, right? To be able to get to that kind of level. But we're not at that level right now.
No.
And when you have, say, crazed radical Muslims who are being, you know, fucking with a lot of human beings, especially in places like Europe, it's not the worst idea to go, maybe you should carry around a weapon. But to be fair, in the Orlando situation, was a little bit odd because I don't know about carrying around a weapon while drinking and grinding up on a bunch of dudes.
No.
You know, that might not be the best of things.
No. And as far as personal responsibility, I don't know anyone in this world who would think that that having any kind of a deadly weapon and having access to a deadly weapon, especially a firearm, under the influence of any mind-altering substance would be a wise choice or one that is a safe one.
Yeah, so it does get into the question of how do you have a conversation regarding the Orlando situation?
Well, yeah, that's the thing is right now, Carlos, we are getting shouted down and at every opportunity, and this is something that that I've seen the regressive left use as a methodology quite often, is to simply shout down any idea, even the question of saying, "What if we tried arming people?" This is something, this is a tactic that has been employed for probably roughly the last decade or so, in spite of the fact that there's plenty of data that you can garner from any state explaining that concealed carry permits do not cause an uptick in crime at all. And I think it is almost every state publishes yearly in the first quarter, second quarter, they publish the crime data from their CCW holders, the concealed carry licensees, versus everyone else. And it shows that just because these people understand the gravity of having a concealed carry license, they are far, far less likely to be committing any crime, even a nonviolent one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a correlation causation. Who's the type of person to be willing to actually go out of their way in order to be able to get one of these licenses?
Yes.
White middle class person. That's, yeah. Yeah, I mean, kind of, right? Statistically.
Yeah.
Who's less likely to commit a crime in these situations, but we don't need to get into that. But, I don't know how I feel about certain sentiments, though, that are, like, pushed by the NRA, which is... an armed society is a polite society. Like, well, war isn't really polite and everyone has a gun. That's an argument against guns, but I do have a little bit of issue with the romanticization of weapons as a whole rather than just being a defensive mechanism. And so there's like this fetishization of this survivalist lifestyle whereby people are kind of prepping because they want it to be the case where they have to turn guns against one another. But I don't believe that that's what you're doing in your case.
No.
You're doing it in order to kind of promote the idea that you should be able to defend yourself. Orlando, to me, doesn't even play that big of a role in this conversation because I don't know what the fuck happened in Orlando. I'm going to be honest. A guy shows up to a spot and kills that amount of people with that amount of weaponry in that amount of time? Sounds a lot more like cops started shooting and accidentally killed a lot of gay people. But, you know, just from where the shots were coming from and the actual physics of moving around in that quickly of an area.
Sure. I can offer a little bit of an insight. And,
yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, and I will actually provide a link to you where you can put this into the show notes because it's important that people see it if they so choose. And I will admit that it's a very difficult compilation to read through. And what this is it's published by OPD. And they put out a compilation of basically using time as a base. They put out a compilation of every single 911 call that was active. And one by one, you start seeing the line over and over again. Caller goes quiet. Line goes dead. Line hangs up. Caller goes quiet. So what you see is the first shots happen, if memory serves, and I have a little bit of a longer memory, so I remember most things I read. The first shots seem to be fired roughly around 2:03 or 2:04 a.m. You know, so it's closing time. People are wrapping up. They're closing out their checks. You know, a lot of people are still there. It's about 300 people there. And the cops did not breach the Pulse nightclub until 5:06 a.m. So let's go through that.
Yeah.
2:04 to 5:06, you could have, in my opinion, gone in there with a club and killed 49 people. The thing that they were hearing that was on this transcript over and over again was these sounds of reloading. And I don't mean the sound that people who are familiar with firearms would hear of a magazine being dropped and another one being put in. I mean the guy was apparently, in the transcripts, the sounds of him actually truly reloading 30-round magazines again and again, individually with individual cartridges. So this guy had all the time in the world.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I wasn't there. But I know that it did happen,
it's
Carlos.
No. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm not a truther or whatever.
No.
But it's not hard for me to believe that maybe on occasion during a shooting, as like, for instance, there was one in New York where there was a shooting rampage, supposedly, and the majority of killings were actually done by cops accidentally because they don't really know how to handle weapons.
Yes, yeah, it happened in 2012.
Yeah, most cops actually only shoot maybe like a couple rounds a year whenever they're doing testing. So it was just interesting to me to hear about this guy being able to pull this off and how no one really reacted. I don't know. It's odd to me that if you're holding these people off and being able to clip every single time and taking seconds to do that, then no one would run in. I'm not trying to victim blame. I'm just trying to understand the psychology of what was going on there.
Well, I don't quite know. Obviously, I don't know all the details. I'm not an investigator on the case. I'm a television editor. But one thing I was reading was that there was a speculation due to some threats that were made and some statements that were made by the shooter. So Omar Mateen, he had explained a few times, I believe, that he had a device with him or a vest or something like that.
Oh.
So if you send cops in there, then you don't have 49 killed. Then suddenly you have 300 killed if he decides to blow a vest.
Yeah.
Not a very good situation.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And, you know, when a guy with a Muslim name says he has something strapped to his chest while he's holding a gun, you tend to believe it.
Yeah, well, there was also a degree of confusion because he was speaking largely in Arabic.
And really?
A lot of people don't really realize this. So there's a lot of this that simply, it's not to say that the information's not there, but when you look at that event, when you look at other mass casualty events, there are certain details that the press has been known to simply omit. And that is interesting, isn't it?
Well, they tried to move away from him being Islamic whatsoever, and
deflect.
They went straight to no. He just didn't accept the fact that he was gay. That was the problem. Which there might have been some there, sexual oppression and everything else. But where does it come from? Religion. So yes. And you know, when it came to the press as well, they interviewed, I believe, his father, and he was like, oh, he wasn't a devout religious person. I was like, I don't care about his opinion. He should be arrested. If you fuck up this bad as a parent, there's something wrong with you, and no one should ever trust your opinion whatsoever.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes down to bad parenting in a lot of ways, too.
Yeah. It's a, religion is a form of child abuse if it's done in a specific type of way.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Then there's, I mean, I can say that I came from a largely Catholic background. I'm not really religious now. And
that's good because you're on a libertarian atheist podcast.
Exactly.
Right now,
so. I'm, yeah. I mean, I recognize that, that there are a couple of good things that instilled in me. You know, I'm good to my fellow man. I think that I'm glad that I was taught, not necessarily by the religion, but by friends and family, that volunteerism is probably one of the best virtues. And that's kind of what I took away from that kind of an upbringing, honestly.
Yeah. I don't need to go into my upbringing, but I'll just say, when you try to convince an intelligent kid that there's hell, you end up with either a kid who completely goes, oh, there's no way that's real, or you end up with a really obsessive compulsive kid who's obsessed with the idea of I don't want to burn in hell, so he ends up with a lot of weird personality tics.
Oh yeah.
And I was sadly the latter.
Yeah. Fear is a big motivator.
Absolutely. We can hold up for just 1 second.
Sure.
Alrighty.
All right.
So yeah, I don't know. Anyway, returning kind of back to the topic of the pink guns issue, though. But
pink pistols.
But honestly, the fuck religion and Islam in general. I mean, the fact that so many different people are trying to hide all of this information, I can't quite
more
understand
like
Islam.
Why.
Islam. Like with the Paris attacks as well, and as with the Nice attacks as well. It's like you just keep ignoring what the problem that is obviously in front of your face.
Yeah.
And yeah, I get it. America has done incredibly fucked up stuff to Middle Eastern countries. I'm with you there. And the British government funded Wahhabism and all the good stuff. Let's just stop acting, though, like indoctrinating yourself with a very violent religion doesn't lead to certain things. There's this idea in the world, especially among the left, that is counteracted by their own statements constantly, right? They say that beliefs don't really matter. Right? They're like, oh, the beliefs doesn't matter. But then they have this obscure idea of what is patriarchy and what is racism and everything else. And they say, oh, those are hidden beliefs that you have that you don't even realize you have.
Yeah.
But then you have something like Islam where the hatred towards women and other groups is flagrantly in front of your face.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, it doesn't matter what his religion is. ISIS isn't really Islamic, without ever reading the Quran or the Hadiths and acknowledging the fact that, hey, Muhammad was kind of into fucking 12-year-olds and holding slaves.
Yeah, of
and
course.
Massacring
yeah.
huge amounts of individuals.
Yeah.
And wiping out whole areas. And over the course of Islam, you just a couple hundred years, you're able to knock out more land than the Romans did.
There's a book over my shoulder right now that's called An Autumn of War. And it's about 15 years old. It came out shortly after 9/11. And it's by the inimitable Victor Davis Hanson, who is up at UC Davis. And I believe it's the second chapter is an analysis of Islam, past, present, and future. And the chapter is entitled, Why Are We Being So Nice About This?
Nice.
And
yeah,
it's kind of a harsh analysis of, you know, not just other modern religions, but especially Islam. And, you know, while I'm sure that there's plenty of parts of Islam, parts of the Islamic world, you're talking about 3 billion people. I'm not going to be, you know, painting them all in the same light. But there is a very sizable percentage that we've seen that seems to really support, at the very least, oppressive regimes through Sharia law.
But did you know that the KKK was Christian?
Yeah, and they're also Democrat, so
and
go
that
for that.
A couple times there was an abortion clinic blown up, and therefore Christianity just... Yeah, we fucking get it.
Yeah.
We get that Christianity did a lot of terrible things.
Yes.
And I agree with you.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we have to act like this isn't the goddamn problem.
No, no. But no, it's deflection.
It's deflection, but then... Then they vote Democrat, these fucking nincompoops, who then blow up places, right? Like, Obama will go give a speech that say, you know, the future will not belong to those who kind of besmirch Islam. Something along those lines. I'm sure I'm not directly quoting. You've given me some beautiful whiskey and a fantastic Manhattan. I do thank you for that, but it does, does sometimes lead to the fact that it's hard to directly quote individuals or remember pronouns. But, you know, you have these leaders who are essentially insinuating that Islam isn't a problem or whatever, but then they go around and bomb the fuck out of Islamic countries.
Yes.
And they don't see the fact that that's a problem.
Yes, it's right? Something the CIA calls blowback.
Yeah, which, again, okay, if blowback was completely the issue, then why isn't it Japan is filled with suicide bombers who are trying to assault us all the time, even though after they got nuked?
Yeah.
After you get nuked, it should be the biggest blowback of all time, but instead you ended up with this really interesting civilized society.
Yeah.
Right? Because it...
Again, we don't have to be nice about this. Not all countries are created equal.
Not all cultures.
No, and yeah. That's correct. And when you're talking about Japan, and I know we're bouncing around here, 2011 was a very rough year for Japan. Obviously, northern Japan, you know, much of northern Japan, their infrastructure was destroyed mm-hmm. in, you know, a matter of a few minutes, and, you know, 19,000 people died. And there was a question of... why aren't these people, you know, looting and raiding these areas? It must be because of the radiation. No, that wasn't really the case. The case was simply that the culture there is so homogenous that they wouldn't even think that it was even an option to be opportunistic and steal from an abandoned home that was nearby. That's something that you don't do to other Japanese people. No, they're all in that together, and you know, it's they function in that kind of a society. So that's the reason why.
Yeah, and I'm mixed on obviously the cultural hegemony issue, because there are a lot of things I actually really like about the United States culture wise. There is a lot of collision that occurs, right? Because you have multiple cultures interact with one another.
Yes.
Without the interaction of the state, you know, essentially trying to mix people through force, like the welfare state and public education and everything yes. else, you end up with kind of a beautiful cesspool.
Yes.
And a mixture of ideas. And yes. I'm obviously saying this as a Puerto Rican who has Jewish, Native American, Black, White, all the mixture heritage, right? And tends to have mostly white friends. So maybe I'm just trying to project the fact that, please, white people, don't kick me out.
No, I'm allowed. You basically are privileged. You are white privileged by proxy because of us, Carlos. That's why.
Yes. Yeah. The power.
You have the power in spite of your brownness.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm mixed on the conversation of it. And plus, because I'm also mixed on, you know, within a lot of Asian cultures, you tend to have a massive amount of collectivism.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Which lends itself to, you know, we could say like, oh, isn't it great that, you know, there's cultural hegemony in China, for instance? Mm. Yeah, except that part where they killed like 30 million of their own people over the course of the last 100 years.
Yeah, it was actually closer to, you know, at some estimates, you're looking at maybe upwards of 40 to 45 million.
Yeah, it's mixed. Me and my friend Andrew just did an episode on the topic of free trade, and we kind of went into Mao for a bit there. It's anywhere from 20 to 45, right? It's kind of fucking terrible to even say it like, oh, maybe it was that amount of...
But no, we'll never really know. And yeah. That's just terrifying. That it's scary. This is the quickest way I can put it. It's scary. It's not as scary that it happened. It's scary that people allowed it to happen. That the culture was so homogenous that there wasn't an uprising of people saying, this isn't right. And it's simply because... people were indoctrinated to believe that an uprising is not something that a good Chinese person would do.
Yeah.
So getting back to that, though, the reason that Pink Pistols, I think that the reason the right starts liking us, that, you know, and not to talk about it as a binary sense, but you're talking about the typical right wingers who are just like, don't like them fags. Oh, he's got some guns. Well, it looks like he woke up. Well, you better arm yourself. I'm like, yeah. I learned how to shoot actually in the Boy Scouts. So it's been 27 years since I learned how to shoot on a 22. So, but thank you. I am not new to guns, but the gay community thanks you. But then, that's just the thing, isn't it? Is that they see us as a collective. So the right wingers are starting to wake up a little and think, huh, well, they do have a little bit of individual thought. They do have a little bit of going against the grain, which is how Haley Potts, the reporter who did that story, put it, as saying that, you know, some of us are going against the grain of whatever that grain is. I didn't see in my gay card that I wasn't allowed to own a firearm.
No, fags are only allowed to be liberals. That's, Jesus Christ.
That's right.
Have you ever read Hans Hermann Hoppe?
Yeah.
But yeah, then
degenerates.
Yeah, so then and you know, the radical left does just everything that they typically do, which is simply to throw any kind of dissent that does not go along with their agenda, just run right under the rug. They throw us out off the reservation and they disown us, because dissent is the greatest thing that can break apart modern day progressivism. So it's a very funny thing where we're just kind of in this weird little realm where these gun owners who happen to be gay, who the right wing kind of likes us, the left wing kind of hates us, and we are going especially against what EQCA wanted. And I will tell you a little bit about EQCA.
Acronym stands for?
It's technically an abbreviation. Equality California.
Okay.
Equality California, it started shortly after Prop 8. And, again, they were kind of an integral part of overturning Prop 8. So thank you for the amicus briefs. 2013-2014 rolls around. And this is my take on it. EQCA starts having a problem after DOMA goes away, and starts having a problem after basically federally they started having to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And what do you think that problem is with EQCA?
No idea.
Coffers are drying up. There's no more money coming in.
Oh.
Yeah. This is what happens. Any lobby group achieving an agenda, let's say, in a lobby group is probably one of the scariest moments.
So you have to broaden your scope in order to be able to.
What do we do now?
Yeah.
I received a call late 2014 from EQCA asking for more donations, more money. I said, that's great, but what's on the docket? What do you have planned? And they said, well, we're shifting our focus over to immigration reform. I said, what do you have?
Fags and Mexicans.
Yeah, I know. I was like, there's nothing to do with one really has nothing to do with the other. I was like, well, that's interesting. But I said, well, what do you have planned? They said, well, we have a few bills in the works, but we really need some money. And I said, well, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
And, it was quickly, we kind of got off the phone, respectfully. And, and I just said, I'm sorry, I just can't give to you your organization unless you have bills that are being authored or co-authored and something I can really look up. I can't just give you money for something I don't understand. And we left it there. But
after a certain amount of time, an organization's entire existence is to keep its organization going forward.
Correct.
And this is what you see in academia all the time.
Correct.
You broaden the scope of the problem in order to ensure that the solution is never met.
Correct.
Until the point where it's such a broad issue that you can finally simply state that the entire problem is the very idea of human nature and humans in general and what they tend to go towards, right? So then you always need funding.
Yes, of course you do. Yeah, and
communism.
Yeah, but it's not just that. It's actually something that's much easier in this case, which is simply to scare the shit out of people, and they are very good at doing that. So, June 13th, the day after the massacre in Orlando, EQCA suddenly has their new agenda, and that's gun control. So they pair up with every gun control platform that they can in order to bind their coffers with these other ones. So, no, of course the Pink Pistols go against their agenda, don't you see? They would never back us.
So they were that straight up anti-gun information.
I can show you all
what
the emails.
Homosexuality
emails have to do with
and stealing people's guns?
Well, it's
have to do with one another.
Oh, of course. Well, don't you see though? There is a direct link for that moment. And just as we've all heard the quote from Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. So the crisis was that there were 49 slain homosexuals, young, pretty men and women who were dead in a nightclub, blood on the floors. It's disgusting. It's terrible. It's terrifying. And, whenever there's an outrage for something like that, there's a question of, well, what can we do?
Ooh.
And yeah, so that's where I see it going.
Yeah, because God knows the problem was concealed carry permits.
Well, they called it an easy access to guns, access to military-style weaponry, whatever the fuck that means.
I can turn most guns into military.
Into military.
Yeah, exactly.
Most guns started in as military weapons.
Yeah. Most guns can kill another human being. So that is kind of military type.
Now we're talking semantics. But, you know, if you want to really look at kind of an analogy, you can go back about 30 years. Back in 1987, I think it was, is that you can find the quote in a few places. The official quote from... Josh Sugarman, who is the head of the Violence Policy Center. VPC, Violence Policy Center, is a group that was kind of coming up at the same time as the Brady Campaign. The Brady Campaign at the time, though, was not called the Brady Campaign to prevent gun violence. It was called Handgun Control, Inc. A lot of people don't realize that. Handgun Control, Inc., up until the mid-80s, and then they switched over to be the Brady Campaign because they had this, you know, they wanted to kind of broaden their scope kind of focusing on all guns. But at the time, Violence Policy Center was actually realizing that they, since the Brady Campaign was kind of going against this whole handgun thing, they actually thought, because liberals have no shortage of idealism. They actually thought, because of the ban on handguns at the time in the District of Columbia and the one that was almost identical in Chicago, that all major cities would follow suit. They really believed they would ban all handguns. Violence Policy Center simply needed to fill up their coffers even more with something. And they're like, well, you know, the Bradys already have the handgun thing. We need to go after something else. So you can look up Josh Sugarman's quote, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he's saying, what we can do is we can go after these so-called assault weapons. He's the one who technically started calling them assault weapons. These semi-automatic rifles that look a lot like machine guns, simply because it'll confuse people. You know, an AR-15 looks exactly like an M16, identical to the naked eye, you know, unless you really look at the components of it. So he was realizing that these very popular rifles and pistols that were on the civilian market, that they could actually start to find ways to ban them and get people scared shitless over these very common firearms that really functionally had very little different than standard handgun.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's another example about 25, 30 years ago where they were like, how can we start controlling firearms? So, you know, what can we start banning?
Yeah, just in general.
In general. Yeah.
And on that note, why don't we take a quick break here?
Yeah.
I got to piss like a racehorse, and we'll get back to it. All right. So following up here, we had a much needed another whiskey break. And again, thank you so much for all the beautiful liquid that you've been providing me, which is making for interesting conversation.
Yes.
I did want to jump back, though, into the conversation of just kind of how lobby groups will jump onto whatever fringe thing in order to expand.
Okay, well, I'll break it down simply. This is just my opinion on it. Surely you're familiar with the relatively new fascination with something we call identity politics. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So the idea that a lot of these politicians have is they're like, okay, well, I can, instead of going to through some kind of complex issue about these economic things and carry the two and trickle down this and that up and taxation representation, they can go toward the heartstrings of something. It seems simpler. It's you know, I can understand from a political standpoint. It's and especially in an era of sound bites, I can understand that having a one note emotional issue is something that's much easier to sell to people.
Yeah.
So, what we have again is 50 dead gay people on the floor of a nightclub one Sunday morning. And, you know, the question is, if you're a lobby group, especially one that is gay oriented, but one that is trying to get more followers, and by that I mean more money, if you're a gun control advocacy group and you're trying to simply, again, you're trying to ameliorate this stagnation, what do? You appeal to these people who are perceived victims, collective victims. It's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And the identity politics are obviously being played by both sides now even more so.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, but now with NRA, though, you know, they were trying to actually, promote some sort of advocacy. Oh, no. NRA was trying to appeal to the gay community, where NRA was trying to say, well, we understand that you guys are very much an oppressed people, that, you know, hate crimes do exist, even though I take issue with the idea of a hate crime in general, but that's just me. They were trying to appeal to us in such a strange sort of way. I think that NRA wanted to find a way to get new members as well in the same vein that Every Town for Gun Safety wanted, in the same vein that Brady Campaign wanted, in the same vein that EQCA wanted. But at the same time, they just saw an opportunity to simply appeal for more members. And, you know, by that, it's more money and everything. And what Pink Pistols was, is it's kind of this strange amalgam where nobody really wanted to touch us. NRA recognizes that we're gun owners, we're not necessarily NRA members. But they don't want to shit on us because they don't want to lose members. Brady Campaign kind of wants to shit on us, but they don't want to seem anti-gay. EQCA kind of wants to shit on us, but they don't want to seem completely anti-gay. They don't want to seem like they're starting to kind of like nasty, in a nasty sense, violently subdivide people into different categories of gay, saying if you're a gay gun owner, you don't apply suddenly. You don't fall under our protection. So it's a very interesting time politically.
Yeah.
In probably what is arguably one of the most violent election cycles that we've seen in some time.
Well, right. So the thing is that it's been set up at least since the 70s, whereby it is assumed that if you're a fag, if you're black, if you're a woman, you have to side towards the maternalistic Democratic government party.
That's right. And God help you if you turn your back on them. We gave you marriage. You goddamn better get behind this gun control.
Yeah. And it's immigration gets tied into it. You have a whole nest egg of different points of view that you're supposed to have that go along with the narrative.
Right.
And if they can't quite fight you, they simply ignore you.
Yeah.
Which obviously they're going to be attempting to do with you, along with trying to do this. And I'm sure you're getting this a bit. Are you being called a maybe self-hating gay? Have you gotten that thrown
at
you? I
haven't gotten that one. I've seen people simply say that we've been fueling the fire of the NRA, that I've seen people blame the NRA for Omar Mateen, which, boy, that's quite a contortion.
It's interesting, too, that people, if you watch the Democratic National Convention, people were talking kind of jokingly, oh, I have a failed rating by the NRA. Look how great I am.
Like, I had like a vomit bucket in front of me when I was watching it.
Jesus,
but yeah.
Christ. Yeah. It was like their size of their cunt or dick was directly correlated with how much the NRA hated them.
It wasn't that bad. I lost about 6 pounds that week. It was great. Yeah.
Yeah. Even as if the NRA really stands for complete Second Amendment rights, which it doesn't. They concede points consistently.
Well, and that's why I think that I embrace libertarianism. I've embraced libertarianism since I was 18, and I think it's because, Carlos, that I saw it as this simultaneous, simplistic challenge. It was it's simple to adhere to the ideas of libertarianism because it's consistent.
Yeah.
It's a challenge to live in a free society. It's a real challenge, and I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's not easy, but I truly love living in a society where I live by John Stuart Mill's harm principle. I truly embrace the idea of positive and negative rights. I had the privilege of working with LearnLiberty.org and, put up, several, I think I've done, if memory serves, I've done 8, maybe 9 of their videos for their YouTube channel.
Nice.
And and I think that people over there, like, what's his name, Otterson, and then there's Ian Scable and Ian Scoble, and there's all these other great philosophers that they've had there who have contributed and kind of they've aided in supporting my views and understanding that it's well beyond just reading John Locke, and it's well beyond just reading Hayek and von Mises, that there's
there's so many tenets to understanding self-governance that libertarianism is stronger than ever. And you wouldn't know it if you really just absorbed mainstream media.
Yeah. No, you wouldn't. And that's an unfortunate aspect, of course, of the media, but that is what they do. They try to push their narrative forward by assuming that anyone who is disagreeing with it is on either the fringe or simply evil.
Right. Yeah.
And then, of course, there's a fight back against it, which is where you're getting a lot of the buildup of the alt-right, which is unfortunate because many of their viewpoints are absurd.
Of course.
And they're pushing...
And we're outdated.
Yeah, I mean, they're pushing towards the identity politic as well.
Yes.
But for their argument is that, well, they're going to do it, we're going to do it. And
that's right.
I think
the
that's...
The tactic works.
Yeah.
Just sadly.
Yeah, but so does, you know, murdering groups of people.
Oh, of course.
Tends to take care of a particular type of issue. Is it the right one to do? Not necessarily, depending on your moralistic viewpoint.
Well, so Rick Ziber, who's over at EQCA, he was saying that we are largely a fringe group. And to that I say simply, you can look at a Pew Research poll that simply states that 36% of gay people that they surveyed, and I think they surveyed about 1,000 people, actually supported gun rights. So 36% is not a fringe minority. You know, I think that that is a sign that no, we're not fringe. No, we are not these strange people that don't deserve a voice. I think that if we want to start having this discussion nationwide, that no, you shouldn't just shut us down.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there's some kind of hope to be made with more homosexuals going towards this kind of viewpoint and hopefully not going full Milo with it at the same time.
There's something that bemuses me about Milo.
Oh, it's very funny.
It's so funny.
He's a blast.
I actually could, you know, I really don't agree with a lot of things he says, but I really could sit down and just have a couple of cocktails and just be like, I don't agree with you, but, you know, that's America and you're English, but whatever. You know, I don't think that he fits very well in England, so he just came here for I think he came here for the politics and the fun and the cocktails and a lot of black cock from what I've heard.
He's way into the black cock because he's so silly.
Oh yeah,
it's hard to hate him. I mean, there's like a certain charisma that he has.
Yes,
where
it's the hair.
I haven't even really seen him speak as much as I've heard him speak.
Yes, right,
through like podcasts and things like that. And he has this kind of way about him that's just very kind of fun.
Yes.
And you know he's kind of trolling at the same time. It's a great balance.
Yeah.
But then you know and you've met the people who actually follow him and you're like, God, these people are awful.
Oh, yeah. Which is really funny because it's very strange where it's just like you probably have some kind of, and I hate generalizations, but you have some kind of stereotypical supporter and, you know, in the South or the Southwest of Donald Trump is just like, and I hate those faggots and I don't understand, but that Milo's, he's pretty good. He wears some smart suits.
Yeah. It's like the token black guy, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah. He really is.
He'll only be tolerated for as long as he pushes their agenda.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a very strange thing, this Milo.
Yeah.
It's very fun.
Yeah, but and I understand, like, you know, the push towards it because it's kind of fun, you know, it's a good laugh. But I before we end here, I just kind of want to talk to you a bit about, outside of the politic, your other job, your real job.
Yes.
Which is?
I am a television editor and producer, and I work mainly in unscripted TV. I've worked recently in scripted film.
What's some of the trashiest shows you've worked on?
The trashiest.
Unscripted television is mostly trash.
No.
It's fun.
People think that. They automatically go to the worst of the worst via the Hegelian dialectic in their mind. they always go to like to the Real Housewives or whatever. And I say this as I just came off of a Bravo pilot. But anyway, I've worked on 4 seasons of Biggest Loser, which I think is I think it's a great show. It's not without its controversy. I've worked on a lot of Discovery shows. If there's a couple of Alaska shows that you or your listeners may have heard of, there's Edge of Alaska. I've worked on a lot of different Discovery shows and History Channel shows that involve, you know, a quest or an adventure. And it's a lot of fun to put together because something that people may not realize is that the editor on a scripted TV show, the editor on a scripted film, is directed by a group of people. I would never say that they're a button pusher, but the creativity is largely stifled. In my case, the creativity, the onus is on me. I have to tell that story. I have to craft that story. I have to create this environment, this world. It's very real. I have to get people to understand this Alaska. I have to get people to understand this ice field. I have to get people to understand what it's like to have the trepidation of crossing an ice field in April right before the breakup.
Have you been to Alaska?
I've not been to Alaska.
So you're telling the story.
I'm telling the story visually and with audio and music, and it's a lot like making a movie, but it's all on me, and that's why, in comparison with scripted TV and scripted film editors, by and large, unscripted TV editors, we charge almost twice as much. We make for a movie or TV show, for a documentary or TV show that especially a TV show that garners probably only 100,000 viewers per episode or something like that, we charge an insane amount of money because we're what they call predators. Yeah, we are producer editors. We have to actually make this damn thing turn into a very big, believable show. And yeah, in some cases, for 1 hour of TV, we're shooting about 200, maybe 300 hours of video for just one episode.
So, oh my God.
Yeah. You go through that.
No, I don't.
Yeah. You find somebody to go through that and turn it into a viewable masterpiece with music and the right timing and the right interviews. No, it's a very difficult job.
So you've done these Alaska shows, right? But
that's right.
So I'll be honest. I don't watch a lot of television, not because I'm a pretentious cunt. It's just not something I'm all that interested in, and unscripted television.
Yeah.
Like, I'm obsessed with Mr. Robot right now.
Yeah.
Right? So like kind of that scripted, although the season has been going completely to shit. They're making it too ridiculous. But how much have you, so a show like Real World, this is always something that's kind of bothered me.
Sure.
When two people are outside of the room, but you can see them talking to each other.
Yes.
But you can't really see them, like it's in the shadows. How much of that audio is added in afterwards?
It depends on the scene. It depends on the situation. I will say that a part of my job has been to misrepresent what people have said.
Yeah. We have to, right?
Well, yeah, it's a part of the story.
Most of life is pretty boring. So trying to create a narrative out of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, people who have been in the Marine Corps understand that there's another meaning to USMC. Which is, you signed the motherfucking contract. And that applies in reality shows. Yeah, if they sign the contract, we are under no creative obligation to portray any of what happened.
So it is scripted. It's just the script is created after, post, during editing.
Precisely.
Yeah. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it really is. And this is nothing new to some of the listeners who may have heard things about this before, or allusions to this, that, yeah, I've put words into people's mouths, and it's something I do every day. It's something that we actually call a Frankenbite, where we take an interview and we take words from other interviews and we simply make someone say something that's largely different. But something I'll tell you is that the one show that we could never really Frankenbite ever was one of the most innocuous and honest shows that I ever worked on, and that was The Biggest Loser. We could not re-edit interviews very easily with people from earlier in the season and with contestants from earlier in the season. That's simply because even if it was something that was relatively innocuous, like if I was trying to just get someone to say, today I something, yeah, something, and I just needed to get that cleaner from an interview, say in April, now it's September, and they've lost 120 pounds. They sound completely different.
Oh, Jesus.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's something, isn't it? That's something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just saying that in a general sense so that I don't violate any NDAs, but, you know, it's probably been 11 years since I've really witnessed a lot of these kinds of interviews anyway, but that was really something.
And how much shit have you gotten for working on The Biggest Loser? Like, it's like a sacrificial lamb being burned in front of the public. I mean, getting fat people to run isn't really what's helping them lose weight. Like, it's a really injury-provoking type of way of losing weight. Just cutting down calories significantly is your best option without getting injured. But it's like, I'm not trying to give you crap on it.
Sure.
It's just more a matter of like, what has been the reception when you tell someone that you worked on The Biggest Loser?
So, again, I have some NDAs that run in perpetuity that I can't really reveal certain things, but the thing that a lot of people do understand naturally is that with many of these contestants, there's been a massive calorie restriction along with a diet and exercise regime. With this massive calorie restriction, especially taking them out of an environment, they have successfully lost, you know, in some cases well over 100 pounds within a matter of probably only about 4 months,
which is good. The best way to actually lose weight is to lose it quickly. That's
correct.
That's one of the biggest lies it's told. Is that you have to learn lose it slowly, which doesn't work for anyone.
No, it doesn't.
Because you need to see the results immediately so that you see something. No. It's a complete life changer.
No, of course. Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you my personally that I did have a couple of hormonal problems that caused me to put on, you know, a lot of weight very, very quickly, and I was able to after a couple of years of just questioning, found a specialist that simply helped me through a couple of different ways. I lost probably about 40 pounds in about 70 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I got back to this normal weight. Now, what that has to do with The Biggest Loser is that a lot of these contestants, and this is something you can see in New York Times, so we can finally talk about it, but this is something we did recognize throughout the years, which is that many of these contestants were simply putting the weight back on very quickly, and we couldn't quite figure out why. And that's simply something that has to do with the pituitary gland, which is located in the middle of your brain. And it's kind of a thermostat for a lot of things in your body, hormone regulation, and one of them happens to be your weight, where the body is simply saying, I want to get back what I had before. That thing I had was 210 pounds. I want to get back to that. How do I do that? I lower the thermostat, I lower the metabolism, and I will do everything I can to put that weight back on because something's wrong.
Yeah, I read that Times piece. I mix Ray Cronus, whose book should be coming out soon enough. He helped lose a bunch of weight and a bunch of these other people.
Yeah.
He talked about the fact that he would actually measure metabolisms and he wasn't finding broken metabolisms. What you did find in these people is that they went back to eating the exact same way they were eating before, thinking that they wouldn't gain the weight back.
That can
be. They were like, yeah, I would have the same pizza and eat the same and drink the same Coke as my friends. I gain all this weight. It's like,
yeah, well, and that's true.
Your body is fucked. Yeah. You can't go back to it, junkie.
Yeah, and that's true. That's absolutely true. So, but in a way, though, that's still almost the same thing. So it's, you know, we have all these interventions that we give people, and it's largely at the end of the day, it's a psychological problem that a lot of these people have. For my problem, it was largely a hormonal problem that I'm not going to get into. But, you know, the human body is a very complex thing, and the one thing it always wants again and again is homeostasis.
Yeah.
The human body is always trying to achieve homeostasis, especially if it's something that is simply trying to mitigate any of the, 700 hormones and prohormones that you have in your body.
Yeah.
If it has to mitigate a deficiency in that or a surplus in that, then, well, you know, then it's going to do everything it can to find ways to combat that. So, you know, I think that that especially because of lifestyles and food, that humans have some very serious problems that we just didn't have a century ago with obesity, and that's probably what's causing it. But again, I'm not Dr. Jason Fung in Toronto.
I'm not trying to play the doctor route. I mean, what is really obviously interesting though is how much the gut flora plays a part into this.
That's largely correct. And gut flora can be compromised for any reason.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of science into that, which is quite interesting. But that's nor here nor there. And we're about an hour in.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you very much for being on the show here. Where can people find more about your organization? And
You can find it all at pinkpistols.org. There's also a Facebook group, and there are usually Facebook groups for every chapter. So just kind of look around Facebook, look around Google, and also on the website for Pink Pistols, you can find information on contacting your local chapter. The thing that you should understand is that Pink Pistols is very inclusive. We will welcome anyone, gay, straight, bisexual, anything. You know, we don't care. We don't care what someone feels or what they look like or anything like that. We will take anyone in who just wants to learn about safe gun handling, how to carry guns safely, and especially effective marksmanship.
Fantastic, sir. All righty. Let's go drink some more and eat some food.
That sounds good.
West Hollywood.
That's great.